Deutschlandfunk. Sport am Samstag.
Human rights issues are one of the big topics around this year's sports mega events. We at Deutschlandfunk were able to speak to Shift's vice chair, Rachel Davis, about the issues that sports governing bodies like the IOC and FIFA face regarding human rights. We felt like Rachel Davis was the one to ask. She's an independent advisor. She co-authored human rights recommendations for FIFA and the IOC and was chair of the Independent Human Rights Advisory Board of FIFA, which was pro bono. When I talked to Rachel Davis this week, we started out looking at the IOC and the criticism before the games in Beijing. And I asked her almost 2 years after her human rights recommendations were published, whether she thinks now, well, we told them to deal with this.
Thanks, Marina, and it's great to be with you. We started working at Shift in 2018. With the IOC to build their understanding of their responsibility to respect human rights. And that was 3 years already after the host city contract was signed with Beijing. And as you said, in 2020, the IOC published recommendations that I authored together with Prince Say, the former UN human rights chief, about what it needed to do to advance this work and to advance its human rights efforts. And as Zaid and I stated in our public report, the human rights impacts that could be connected to the Beijing Games are severe and addressing them remains challenging. And so while I'm not in a position to comment on the specific due diligence actions that the IOC is taking in relation to the Games, what I can say is that our expert support since we issued that public report has really focused on the need for the organisation to put in place an overarching commitment and a human rights strategy and a set of due diligence measures to support it to prevent and address human rights risks in order to get ahead of predictably challenging situations in the future and to really build human rights respect and human rights due diligence in from the start of hosting relationships. And it is important to note that the IOC has integrated these expectations into its future host city contracts, which will apply from Paris 2024 and going forwards from there.
So that's interesting because it seemed that you've given your recommendations, then it took quite a while for them to be published. Were you disappointed with the speed of the movement in the IOC?
When we made our original recommendations to the president who commissioned them, we didn't actually expect that the full report would be made public. So the fact that that happened was actually a really important development, I think. And it created an opportunity for broader debate and also for other stakeholders to raise these issues with the IOC, which they were already doing. But I think this has helped that discussion. So we actually saw the release of the recommendations as positive. And it certainly has been the case that the IOC has since then done one of the most important things, which was to hire someone with accountability for this, to create an internal structure, a unit with responsibility for human rights, and to start developing a strategy. So we're seeing the first steps, but I think everyone who works on human rights always wants things to happen faster. We're always impatient for better outcomes.
What's the movement you want to see next, or what do you believe is the most urgent thing the IOC needs to do now?
So in our recommendations, we urge the organization to make a formal amendment to the Olympic Charter and to support that policy commitment with a strategy. And with a set of clear actions internally. And this, the IOC has said publicly that it's working on this. It is working on this. And I think we're going to see pretty shortly in 2022 some more progress on those really important steps. And that, as I said, when you put that together with the commitment that it's made now to integrate human rights expectations into host contracts going forwards, that's going to lead to change. But even in the interim, the IOC has made progress on a different area, which is the inclusion of transgender and intersex women in elite sport. They released a framework late last year addressing this topic, and that was grounded in engagement with women who had been severely impacted and hearing from a wider range of views, including human rights experts. And so I think that already shows the potential For what the organization can do when it gets serious about a human rights topic.
Yeah, I mean, we're focusing on Beijing, for example, right now. There's a broad set of different things that you say that the IOC needs to consider, for example, LGBTQI plus rights or women's rights. We're aware of this, and I don't want to spare this in this interview, but still, you're also talking about reasonable expectations of the IOC for human rights issues in your report. So can you tell me what, from your point of view, the reasonable expectations from an organization like this can be? Because here, you know, there's a discussion on whether the public is asking too much from an organization like this.
So I think we see that sports bodies, and not just the IOC, but also FIFA as well, are increasingly recognizing that they have a responsibility to respect human rights, but they're grappling with what that means. We have an international standard. The UN set the standard a decade ago. It's called the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. And both FIFA and the IOC have integrated that into their expectations of future hosts. But for sports bodies organizing events, this really means that they then need to follow up on those expectations by doing three things. So first, they need to conduct due diligence to understand the negative impacts that the event could have on people's rights. Of course, that looks different in different countries. Secondly, they've got to then work to prevent and mitigate those risks, starting with the ones that are most severe, to people. And third, they have to really seek to continuously engage and use their leverage with partners in the host country to try to address human rights risks. And if you think about the life cycle of a major sport event, it's pretty obvious that you have your greatest leverage as a sports body right up front at that early phase. And that's the change or the shift that we need to see sports bodies making, which is, you know, that you build this right in from the beginning, that you go in with your eyes open, that you identify predictable risks, you have and you're ready to have some, yes, probably tough conversations, but this is set out in the UN Guiding Principles in a way that is clear for sports bodies about the scope of the risks they need to be looking at and the kinds of actions they need to take. So I would say it's about sports bodies building the muscle to do human rights due diligence and getting used to doing it as part of organizing major events.
So that's what you mean when you talk about the difference between concepts of influence and connection to impacts. So building a muscle to have this sort of leverage, as I understand. From what you're saying, to me, it comes down to bidding processes and host city contracts, basically, as the key leverage an organization like this has. So in the end, would this mean that if the IOC negotiates with future host countries, what they can do is just tell them, if you don't do this and that, we're not giving you the event?
I think negotiations are always more complex than that, but I do think what you're getting at is important. So setting the right terms in a contract is basically the foundation for managing human rights risks and using leverage, but it's also everything that comes after the contract. So it's about the kind of relationship you build and how clear you are upfront about those expectations, but then continuing to monitor the risks to see if things have changed, to build really good working relationships with your partners, and to do that right up and through the event itself, and of course looking at its legacy as well. And I think, you know, it can help organizations can feel more confident. Oh, we put something in a contract, right, we're done. But actually what we see in practice is that it's the hard work that comes after the contract that matters just as much. But if you set the right terms, if you set the right foundation, you're much more likely to get better outcomes for people, greater respect for human rights at the end of the day.
What did you feel like, considering the leverage the IOC is using right now, when you looked at the case of the Chinese tennis player Peng Shuai and IOC's actions regarding this case?
So again, I can't comment specifically on the steps that the IOC is taking around around that case, because we have an ongoing relationship with them. But what I can say is that, you know, the UN guiding principles, which set the standard and which the IOC, we are recommending that the IOC embrace, expect organizations to use their leverage where the risks to people are greatest. And there's no doubt that sexual harassment and abuse is pervasive in sport. It's an issue that so many women athletes and girls have faced. And they shared that with Zaid and with myself when we were working on the report. So there is a really important role for the IOC to play on that topic. It has taken steps on that topic already. And sexual prevention of sexual harassment and abuse is explicitly included in the Olympic Charter as an area for the IOC to lead on. So again, I think this is where the recommendations we make can help the organization build its muscle to use its leverage and to do so in a way that is respectful and sensitive towards the experience of those who have suffered sexual abuse or assault.
So before we widen our perspective a little bit also towards FIFA, just for me to be clear, what is your role right now after you've given the report with the IOC?
So my organization, SHIFT, is providing advice to the IOC on how to take those strategic recommendations that Zaid and I made and put them into operation. So we are advising the head of human rights in particular on how to develop the strategy, develop a potential amendment to the Olympic Charter, which the organization has said that it's committed to doing, and to really embed this in how the organization takes decisions on a forward-looking basis. So having put all that effort into the report, we really want to see it happen. And what FIFA does, what the IOC does, really matters. We need these organizations to succeed, because if they get this right, that sets a real precedent for other sports bodies. Of course, it matters to the people directly affected by what FIFA, by what the IOC does, but it also matters to people affected, obviously, more broadly in the Olympic movement. And that's why, as an organization, we're really committed to engaging with them to see this put into practice.
So you were part of the Independent Human Rights Advisory Board of FIFA. From an outsider's impression, and even, you know, timeline-wise, FIFA is a lot more advanced on this topic than the IOC. Is this correct from your point of view?
So FIFA was the first sports body to adopt a statutory provision that committed it to respect human rights in line with the guiding principles. And it did that in 2016. And that was in response to a report that we at SHIFT co-authored with Professor John Ruggie, who was the author of the UN guiding principles. And FIFA has been working since then to turn that into practice. And I was the chair of the Independent Human Rights Advisory Board to FIFA from 2017 to 2020. That was a group of eight fully independent experts from trade unions, NGOs, business, and the UN. And we were also totally pro bono. And we issued a series of public reports which document how FIFA made significant progress in a number of areas over that time in meeting its statutory commitment in really putting that into practice. But of course, there are also areas where it still has a lot of work to do. And we highlighted that in particular in our last report, that's true in the area of governance and ensuring that human rights is taken seriously in all the major decisions of the organization.
Did you get the impression that they took it seriously, or that they are taking this topic seriously and not like some fans would say, you know, it's paperwork, it's nice, but it's also just in written language?
Well, we all want to see more than words on paper. I think that's certainly at the heart of human rights. It's actually seeing that translate into differences for people. So I guess I'd answer that question by saying, I think we have seen FIFA start to make some differences on the ground. So some examples would be the efforts it took to get secure the release of Hakim Al-Araibi, who was an unlawfully detained refugee football player. Also in insisting that women be allowed into football stadia in Iran. Also, some of the support, the packages of support that it's now providing for survivors of really appalling sexual abuse in cases like Afghanistan, but coming up in other countries as well. So we are starting to see some practical effects. We've also seen FIFA use leverage to support greater respect for migrant workers' rights around the stadia in Qatar. And we've seen credible organizations like BWI, the Global Construction Workers Union, and the International Trade Union Confederation, you know, confirm that progress is happening. But there's a long way to go for workers outside the walls of those stadia, and some real questions about how their rights will continue to be protected after the last game is played. So I think FIFA has ongoing work to do, and I think the organization knows that.
So they even want to mitigate human rights violations even when they're not directly to blame, is what they're writing, or what you also recommended. How is this doable for a sports organization?
So what the UN guiding principles on business and human rights expect is that sports bodies, like any organization that conducts commercial activities of any kind, that they will prevent and address harms, impacts on people's human rights that they cause or contribute to themselves directly, but also that they will make efforts to address impacts that are linked to their operations. And that's where you see the importance of focusing on, for example, the situation of migrant workers, not just in the stadia, but in all of the support services that are involved in hosting the World Cup, and also the roles of whether it's just, you know, the volunteers who are clearly in the stadia, but also journalists, the security services. And so you can see how there are impacts on people that FIFA may not be causing directly, but they're very clearly linked to its event. And so this global standard says very, very clearly, and FIFA has accepted that that's the standard it should apply. And that it should look at impacts on these kinds of impacts on people as well.
So we talked about FIFA and the IOC and, of course, this year's events, because that's what people are focusing on right now. From your point of view, did both organizations in some way hit rock bottom when they gave those events to these countries? And was that a certain turning point?
Well, they made those decisions certainly well before they had probably even become aware of the UN guiding principles on business and human rights and the international standard that we now see them turning towards. So I think those decisions were made at a different time in a different era when we didn't have the clarity that we do now. And I think the fact that both of them have adopted them, integrated them into decisions for future events, and now the challenge they face is to work on really building that implementation, building that muscle, as I said, the human rights due diligence muscle, shows that they understand the direction of travel, and they understand what athletes and fans and others are saying really matters in sport, which is that we need to put people at the heart of sport. It's easy to say, and it's actually hard work to do, and we need to see more of that.
But still, how does it really match or align when IOC President Thomas Bach, for example, keeps saying that the IOC can't change countries, and the IOC says regarding that even politicians seem not to be able to solve some of these big issues, kind of the IOC is being asked too much. How does this align with the efforts that you're pointing out?
So the expectation in the UN guiding principles is really clear on this. Sports bodies are not responsible for every human rights risk that happens in a country where an event is being hosted, but they are expected to tackle those risks that are connected or linked to their event. And that means that they should go in with their eyes open, understanding the predictable risks that could be linked and what reasonably can be done about them. And they should use their leverage, you know, early and consistently to try to address them. And of course, some of these risks can be harder to address in some countries than others, and particularly when national legislation is conflicting with international human rights standards, or, you know, where government practice falls below international human rights standards. But that requires upfront dialogue with the host government about the universal conditions under which a sports event can be held successfully and with respect for all the participants, for fans, for athletes, for local communities, workers, journalists. And so, you know, again, if we think about the life cycle of an event, it's logical that sports bodies have the greatest leverage for those conversations, that assessment and those conversations upfront. And the more they can do upfront to set the stage, the better the results will be later.
So last question, what do you expect from both sports governing bodies this year while the events are going on?
I think we want them to do what they can, recognizing that the contracts themselves may not contain the clear new expectations that future contracts do. But we want them to do what they can with the leverage that they have. That's what we would say the UN guiding principles expect. And that's what I think those sports bodies also understand as well. But we would expect to see in the future that that's grounded in a contractual commitment, which can make the leverage, the exercise of leverage easier when you start it earlier and from that basis.